This is Viva Fry.
I'm Dr. Peter McCullough.
This is Tom Luongo.
This is Chuck Prodnick.
This is Alex Kraner.
Hey, this is Brad Wall.
This is JP Sears.
Hi, this is Frank Peretti.
This is Tammy Peterson.
This is Danielle Smith.
This is James Lindsay.
Hey, this is Brett Kissel, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Tuesday. How's everybody doing today? Well, I tell you what, it is Christmas season. We're into December. Christmas just around the corner, and you know, if you're looking for a good stocking stuffer, just saying, silver, gold, bull, get a silver coin for all your kids, your wife, your spouse, your husband, and yeah, light them up on Christmas morning with a chunk of silver. Just throwing some ideas out there. I started that a couple of years ago, and I don't know if the kids get it or not, but I make sure that they don't make those things disappear. Either way, Christmas is right around the corner. When it comes to precious metals, buying, selling, storing, using your retirement accounts to invest in precious metals, you can text or email Graham down in the show notes for details. For this side of things, I make sure to grab a couple silver coins for the old Newman stocking stuffer. I think it's a pretty cool way to open up a couple different conversations. And, you know, like they get a bunch of junk in there, my opinion. I love you, wife, but at times it's just a bunch of junk. And I like to sneak in a coin just to, you know, kind of remind them, here's what's really going to stand the test of time. And if you're looking into anything precious metals-wise, go to silvergoldbull.ca.com. And Graham can help you with any of the purchases there. Just make sure to reference the Sean Newman Podcast. Profit River. All right. When it comes to firearms, these are the guys. Another cool stocking stuffer might be something from Profit River. Full stop. I tell you what, they got some pretty cool knives and things that would probably fit. I don't know how you put a, you know, a shotgun in a stocking stuffer. That'd be pretty cool if my wife is listening. That'd be pretty cool too. Regardless, when it comes to firearms, Profit River is the place to go. And when you're making any purchases, make sure to reference SMP. Use the coupon code SMP, and that gets you into monthly draws. You can also email snp@profitriver.com. Say hello to Joel. And when it comes to firearms, optics, and accessories, they serve all of Canada. They are the major retailer. Just go to profitriver.com. Rectech Power Products, for over 20 years, they've been committed to excellence in the power sports industry. And I'm here to tell you they're a heck of a lot more than just ATVs and snowmobiles. They got boats. Did I mention Lund fishing boats? I know we're into the winter season, but, you know, you want to surprise your husband? Get him a boat. I mean, okay, maybe nobody's doing that. But when it comes to... I'm all over the place. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Rectech, when you go in there, they got everything. You know, once again, ATVs, snowmobiles, yes, but they also have a whole line of Sea-Doo. They also have Lund. They got the Alberta built trailers, aluminum trailers. And it's an impressive showroom. So if you're driving through Lloydminster, make sure you stop through Monday through Saturday on the west side of Lloydminster, or you can visit them online, rectechpowerproducts.com. Planetcom. When it comes to growing your growing and running your business, trying to stay on top of the ever-changing world of information tech can be overwhelming, to say the least, and they want to take care of that for you, leaving you to do your thing while they do theirs. For the past 22 years, Planetcom has been here to boost your productivity by proactively managing every aspect of your IT infrastructure, both in the house and in the cloud, and this ensures you're not too tangled up in technology to get anything done. And if you want to check out some of their handiwork, just go to theseannewmanpodcast.com and you'll see what Planetcom's all about. You can also visit them, planetcom.ca, to see everything. The MASH spiel coming January 17th to a small town Alberta near you. That's Kalmar, just west of the International Airport. It's going to be a Saturday. We're going to have a little bit of a turtling bond, like, listen to me today. I'm all over the place. Curling bond spiel. Woo. Hurling. Anyways, it's going to be a nice, relaxed day. You can sign up as an individual. You can put in a team of four. And we hope to see you there. The details for that, the show, showpass.com/mashspiel. That's down in the show notes. You can also text me if you're having problems finding it. The other thing coming is the Cornerstone Forum, March 28th. And it's going to be at the Westin Calgary Airport. So we're back in Calgary. But here's the thing, okay? Just wherever you're at. Early bird tickets end December 31st. So you got a month, 31 days. Actually, less than that. What are we at? 30 days. On January 1st, prices are going up. So you need to get your tickets. All right, folks. I know there's a whole bunch of you procrastinators. I'm one of them. But don't wait past December 31st. For the love of Pete, get on it today. Get on it this month. Buy your tickets. Book your hotel room. Get it all taken care of. The Cornerstone Forum returns March 28th in Calgary at the Calgary Weston Airport Hotel. It's all going to be there. If you're flying in, it's a 24/7 shuttle to the hotel. Nice and easy. And we got a whole lineup coming together. Tom Longo, Alex Craner, Vince Lansky, Matt Eric, Chad Prather, Karen Katowski, Sam Cooper, Tom Bodrovics, twos, and more to come. All right? If you're listening or watching on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, Substack, make sure to subscribe. Make sure to leave a review. Make sure if you're enjoying the show to share with a friend. All right, let's get on to that tale of the tape. Our first guest is a former research chemist, amateur dairy goat farmer, libertarian economist, whose work can be found on Zero Hedge and Newsmax Media. He hosts the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. The second, a Croatian national, former hedge fund manager, author, and contributing editor at Zero Hedge. I'm talking about Tom Luongo and Alex Craner. So buckle up. Here we go. Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast, joined by Tom Luongo, Alex Craner. Gentlemen, thanks for hopping back on the show.
Thank you, Sean. Appreciate it. How you doing, Alex?
Doing incredibly well, Tom. How are you, Sean? Good to see you. Nice to meet together. And yes, let's rock and roll.
Well, let's rock and roll. Tom, I'm throwing you right to start to hop this thing off, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, I think we should probably talk about the peace negotiations that are going on in Miami, because I think they're the most important part of the conversation right now. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but like ending the war that could start World War III is kind of important. So I'm cautiously optimistic. Actually, I like the way the Americans are handling this. They went to Miami, which is a way of saying Washington's insecure. So we're actually going to have real conversations of a relatively secure nature that we can then take back to the Russians so that there's no leaks. That's what that tells me. And I also like the fact that the Ukrainians are walking away from, and they're not very happy about the situation. And that's also a very good sign.
Tom, for the audience with the peace talks, who's all there? And what, I mean, obviously it's about Russia, Ukraine, but I mean, maybe you could just give us a little bigger picture on what's happening down in Florida.
Well, I mean, like we start with, the leaked 28-point plan that's now having been gone through a couple of rounds of negotiations, right? That came out, a week and a half ago. And of course you have to ask yourself who leaked it and why, and what, what was the purpose and blah, 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 blah. And we could have that conversation. And Alex and I have kind of already had that conversation. So is everybody else in the world. Right. What's going on now is that now that we've had initial overtures made, right. The big question now is, and again, this is all happening with Venezuela at the same time, which I think is absolutely related. But now what's happening in Miami is the next round of talks. Like they've got, the Trump administration got the Ukrainians to accept in theory, a lot of things that they were never willing to accept before. The minute you got the EU and the UK out of the room, and then also pushed the Ukrainians on the corruption front, which I think also broke this wide open. And I think that that was clearly a leverage play by Trump and company. We've got movement on this. Now, are the Ukrainians going to roll over and give, the Russians everything they want? No. I think the bigger question for Trump, and I think the reason why this is going to go back and forth even a couple more times, is he can't come out of this looking like Putin's bitch, for lack of a better term, because that's going to give him his domestic enemies a whole lot of talking points that he doesn't want it, that he can't afford right now. So that's what I'm seeing right now. I don't know, but Alex is nodding, so I'm going to turn the microphone over to him.
Thank you for the microphone, Tom. I agree with what you say, and I think it's probably the most important thing going on today in the world, for the reason that you mentioned. I think it's understandable why it's such a painful process, because I think the most powerful stratums of the establishment in the West are desperate to keep the war going, and they're desperate to keep it going as long as they need to get the next lineup to continue that war, you know, Finland, Baltic states, Poland, Romania, Moldova, whoever, you know, and they're frantic preparations for that war going on in Europe. But, you know, once the peace is signed, and I think still one of the most, well, there are some very powerful provisions in the original 28 peace plan, which I think is what it's going to come down to, is that on the one hand, Ukraine will commit never to become a member of NATO or any other kind of Western alliance, never to have Western troops, never to have military exercises without an okay from Moscow. I mean, military exercises with other Western militaries participating, and that they will enshrine this into their constitution, the neutrality, the non-participation in Western military alliances. So that becomes part of their constitution. And then on the Russian side, they will, you know, commit not to invade any other countries in the West, which, you know, Russians have been saying this all along. We're not interested in going anywhere farther from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. They're not even interested in going to Western Ukraine. But by virtue of passing a law, because that's a requirement of the peace plan, passing a law internally to legalize that commitment in Russia's internal laws, that no invading Western countries. Well, that's going to take... That's going to make all those cries the Russians are coming fall flat. They're going to lose all credibility, and so that's going to make it really difficult for the warmongering section of the European leadership to say, oh, they're going to come and invade us because Putin has made it clear that he, after Ukraine, he wants Putin never made that clear at all. They're just talking nonsense. But it's going to be very hard to make that claim and not look ridiculous, because, you know, the counterclaim is, what do you mean? They just passed a law that they will not do this. So what, right. You know, and then, of course, you're going to fall back on James Clapper's. Russians are genetically disposed to lying and cheating. So but, you know, you're going to have to be grasping at straws to get people excited about going to war against Russia. It's just, I don't see it happening if the peace is based on these on this framework. And then territory schmterritory, you know, the Russians are never obsessed with territory and with maps. You know, the fact that Odessa is a Russian city. Russians can take control of Odessa without doing it in the military way. You know, they do it, you know, like if they take control of Kiev, that is, they turn Kiev into a friendly government that's friendly to Russia, then, you know, they take control of Kiev in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that then ushers in a completely new security architecture, not just for Ukraine, but also for the whole rest of Europe, because it will make NATO obsolete. Not that it hasn't been obsolete since 1991, but now even the most imaginative justification for NATO's continued existence becomes obsolete itself. So I hope that things turn out this way. And I think that they are being pushed in this direction by the strongest players in the world, i.e. Russia and the United States. and it's being opposed by the weakest players, meaning the, you know, a very, very narrow segment of European leadership. Not that they're not numerous, you know, in places like Brussels and London and Paris and Berlin, but they don't have the support of the people. You know, the nobody in Europe wants to go to war, which is natural. People never want to go to war. The best they can get out of it is to come back intact. But, you know, their countries invariably and inevitably are going to be decimated, and you're going to have devastations, destroyed economy, destroyed infrastructure, and on and on. So nobody wants this except for, you know, Macron and his lackeys, Friedrich Merz and his lackeys, Starmer, and the people who are part of this hierarchy opportunistically, not because they have any strong convictions, but because they see it as a good thing for their careers. And so all of that's going to fall apart.
To further your point, Alex, and your rundown on the European / British angle on this is correct. What I was getting at earlier was that in Trump House also has the bigger problem, really. And I think this is where we are. I think he's already, like, you know, set the European aside. He's basically said they're not part of this. The Russians are like, they're not a part of these talks in any way. And so, you know, that's in many ways, I almost feel like that's already been settled. The big question now is how can Trump navigate this within the domestic political scenario? Because what we're seeing from the Europeans is clearly all of their NGO and intelligence services operations to weaken Trump domestically. And these peace. And so if you start thinking like those people are, well, how do we turn this positive for Trump into a negative? You turn that positive into a negative by turning him into Putin's bitch. Right. And so Trump has to walk up, and Marco Rubio have to walk a very, very fine line here. And I can tell you that if you look at the way the social media space is framing all this, every time Marco Rubio gets involved as Secretary of State, no less, this is how dumb these talking points are, but it doesn't matter. And you can see it. Rubio's trying to destroy the peace by taking away, by crossing all of Russia's red lines because he's really a neocon and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that's all nonsense. He's literally in the room walking the Ukrainians down and saying, sorry, you get nothing. You've lost the war. We're here negotiating this for what's best for America, and you're going to take what we give you. He's been very clear on this, and so has Witkoff and everybody else. So Witkoff's on his way to Moscow now to talk to Putin. And, like, so the framing of all of this is very important because that's what's being launched everywhere in the slop of the information space, because Trump is really fighting a fifth generational war against his own intelligence services, which is why I brought up Venezuela in my opening remark, because that's really where this exists now. This exists as a means by which to end their control over American foreign policy, American domestic policy, and everything else. And that's where the real split between the United States, City of London, Brussels, France, you know, all of that complex, NATO, all of that is in process. And you can see at every turn, the typical people, did you see Radek Sikorski closes the Russian consulate in Poland over the sabotage of Polish rail lines, which no one can prove that the Russians did. Like, why would the Russians sabotage Polish rail lines? The Russians can't move their logistics on Polish rails because they use a different rail gauge than they do in Ukraine. Like, than they do, the Russians are on a different rail gauge. Like, Russian military logistics end at the Ukrainian-Polish border because their trains run on a different rail system. Okay. So all of this, as to Alex's point, all of this nonsense about the Russians invading the rest of Europe is nonsense, because the Russians still use trains as their primary means of military logistics. They don't use, you know, they don't do things the way Americans do. They don't do things the way the NATO does. So the lie has always been that, oh, the Russians can invade Europe. Because what you do when you lie like that is you leave the imagination of the people to leave to the imagination of the people that you're telling this lie to that, oh, they must have the exact same military logistics that we have. We can do this big airlift, and we can do the ground lift, and we can do the sea lift. The Russians can't do any of that. None of it. They don't. They still to this day don't, which is why they needed to take Pavrovsk, why they needed to take Kupiansk, why they needed to take all these particular cities in their march across the Donbass, because these are all rail hubs. So I think it's, you know, we're at the end stage of this negotiation, and the big point now for the for Trump and his State Department and his negotiators is to craft a solution that looks like he wins more than Putin wins in the process. That's it. And if we think of it in those terms, that's the way we should watch to see the way the final stages of this negotiation play itself out. Because to Alex's point, which is something I was saying, we were talking about last week when the last time you and I were on together, Alex, the whole 28-point piece, or, you know, original, you know, version 1.0 or 0.1 beta, whatever you want to call it, of the peace deal, I read the whole thing and went, oh, this is a perfect, this is a great Russian document, because the Russians can take Odessa and Mykolaiv and anything else they need by other means than sacrificing men at it. And Alex, you know, even if the new leadership in Kiev isn't Russia friendly, as long as they're not Russian antagonists, then eventually Odessa is going to, will fall to the Russians either by a referendum or something along those lines. And in, you know, 3 to 5 years. And as long as the hostility towards ethnic Russians within Ukraine at a institutional level, not at a personal level, but an institutional level, as long as that pressure stops, then they can stabilize the situation, and then they can move forward, and we can get all this done without a loss of life. And of course, that the people who want more loss of life are the ones that have wanted more loss of life for the last 350 years. So there we go.
Am I correct in saying the peace deal, what you're talking about, that Ukraine can never join NATO or a Western alliance and things like that? Isn't this what they've been talking about for like 4 years, and nobody would, oh, we can't do that, we got to push them all the way out, all these different things, and we've lost, you know, a crazy amount of life now? Isn't it just getting back to what the original peace talks were about?
It's not even getting back. That point never changed. You know, the Russians made this clear from day one. They set out, they had four major objectives: making Ukraine a neutral state, denazifying Ukraine, demilitarizing Ukraine, and preventing it from becoming a member of the NATO. That's been the 4 points that they said when they launched the special military operation. These are the four main objectives of the military operation. Thank you very much. We are doing this to address the root causes of this conflict, not for territorial gain. Because, you know, when they launched the special military operation February 2022, they immediately, like after 3 or 4 days, they reached out to Kiev, or maybe Zelensky's government reached out to the Russians, whatever. Either way, they immediately started negotiating. And then over the next few weeks, towards late May, they already had an agreement. And by that agreement, the Ukrainians said, okay, fine, we're going to be neutral, we're not going to join NATO. And the Russians said, fine, you do that, we're withdrawing completely to the lines before the start of the military operation. So they were not even talking about staying anywhere in Ukraine, not even the Donbas. The Donbas was supposed to have a special status within Ukraine. And then the only issue that remained was the issue of Crimea, that they agreed would be negotiated over the next 10 to 15 years. So Russians were going to withdraw completely, and the war was going to end there for those two reasons. Commit to neutrality, commit to never joining NATO, and we're done. We call it off. And then, you know, everybody in the West went insane. Boris Johnson parachutes into Kiev, and he persuades Zelensky and his government that, you know, there's going to be so much money sloshing around here, you don't want to miss it. But he probably didn't persuade him in those terms, but that was certainly part of it. Basically, you know, we're totally behind you. You're going to defeat the Russians. Russia is weak. They're, you know, it's coming apart at the seams. You're going to win and you're going to make a lot of money. And so stay with it. And then they went like, okay. So they tore up the peace deal with the Russians. And, you know, 1.5 million Ukrainians later, they're back to the same thing, only this time they lost about 22% of the country. They're at risk of losing more. They lost their whole army, pretty much, their whole air force, pretty much, air defense, pretty much all of it. They lost, I don't know, at least 10 million of their inhabitants. Ukraine was in 1991, when they got their independence from the Soviet Union, they were at 51 million. They're something between 20 and 25 million now. It's like an absolutely spectacular demographic collapse. It's a complete, total calamity. I don't think they have a country left. It's going to be very, very difficult to rebuild Ukraine into anything for decades. So, yeah. That's the West weaponizing Ukraine for their own objectives and sacrificing the whole country for the project of attacking Russia, provoking it into a quagmire, weakening it, regime changing it, and then using Russia, weaponizing Russia against China to take control of the world island, you know, the Macandarian nonsense that people seem to be still attached to.
Yeah, it's even worse because they wanted the Americans to fight that war for them.
Oh, well, of course, but that's a given, you know, they're not going to fight it.
Right.
Of course.
There are no British people left, right? Apparently, like they're all, you know, Pakistanis.
They're there, and they're mostly there as instructors, you know.
I know.
And okay. You're being.
It was my attempt to dry humor, Alex. That's all.
Okay, I'm sorry. That just went over my head.
I don't usually do dry humor, right? I'm just like, whoa. Okay. That's what I meant. It's like, no, it's not there any British people left. We have to get the dumb Americans to fight for them. Like, you know, like, and that's the way they see us. That's the way the entire European, you know, oligarch class sees us. And now we're like, yeah, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing that either. And that's the big thing. Like, The big shift, and I've been seeing this coming since probably well before we had our first conversation, the three of us together, but I know since the first time I've talked to Alex, which is I've always seen the generational shift coming, attitudinal shift coming generationally within the American people, that they were never going to be willing to put their lives on the line for NATO, for Israel, for this, for any of these British projects. And so this is why I've been saying for years that there's been this kind of Davos, high table, whatever you want to call it. The old European colonial architecture had a very strong countdown clock, and they had to get this project done in a certain amount of time or it was never going to work. And that's why they freaked out at Trump one, the Trump administration, season one of the Trump show, why they had to get control of things during from 2020 to 2024 in order to try and push this thing again forward even farther. Right. They were planning. Clearly planning on stealing the election in 2024. They tried killing him. Then they tried stealing the election. That failed. We're starting to see all that stuff come out now. But, you know, once you get past a certain point, like the millennials don't want to fight for these people. Gen Z barely even want to fight for America. Like, you think they're going to fight for Emmanuel Macron? Like, really? Like, so their entire read of the world and of what the Americans are willing to put up with is, you know, it's completely out of date. And not only is it out of date, but it's also now desperate to try and figure out how they can get us involved in a thing that we don't want to do. So when I look at what's happening now, I think that we should probably shift the conversation to what's their next move. Because if Trump and Putin and force Ukraine to sign a peace deal that the Europeans don't want, what's their next move? And that's why I keep coming back to how can they destabilize, and you know, how can they enact revenge against us for not giving them their cookie, their Russian cookie, right? And that's what I'm completely focused on that as an analyst, because I almost think that this thing has been put to bed. At least, you know, I mean, if the Europeans want to go to war, you know, on behalf of Ukraine here, they're more than welcome to do so. And we're more than welcome to sit back and watch them, you know, fail completely. And because Americans are not going to fight in this war. That's, I think, is abundantly clear. Alex?
Well, I certainly hope so, Tom, you know, but the precedents are not good in the sense that, you know, World War One, the Americans didn't want to fight that war, but they got dragged into it. World War II, the Americans didn't want to fight that war either. They got dragged into it. And I think that the calculation of the Europeans is, let's get into a shitload of trouble, and then the Americans are not going to be able to just leave us in our shit, and they're going to have to come to our rescue. So I think that that's at the, you know, like it's at the top echelons in Europe, that's the calculation. That they're going to, you know, start the mess as they did in World War One and World War Two, and then they're going to have this very intense, you know, backstage diplomacy, helped with some false flag attacks, you know, Lusitania, Pearl Harbor. They're going to come up with something. And then, you know, as is usually the case, they have the media on their side because, you know, the media, they never saw a war that they didn't fall in love with. And so, you know, you can envision a scenario in which shit hits the fan in Europe. The media starts reporting Russia bad, poor Europeans, you know, the evil Russians are bayoneting the babies and raping women and, you know, killing civilians and cutting their bellies open and stuffing them with, you know, whatever, you know, like the really gruesome kind of shit that they did to get the Americans into World War One. And then, you know, figure out how to blow up something in the United States or an American ship or something like that. And to say, aha, the Russians did it. Now you have to join us and we all go to kill the Russians together. So that, you know, at the moment, the mood is the Americans are not going to get involved. But I guarantee you these people have plans. They have plans and they're not going to give up. They're just not going to give up. You're going to have to completely disenfranchise them, drag them out to like military tribunals, destroy their system altogether. You're going to have to do that. And I think that this is the reason why Vladimir Putin for the 20 almost 6 years that he's been in power, never gave up on the United States. He never shut the door to cooperation with the United States, in spite of the abuse and humiliations he suffered from, you know, Clinton regime, Obama regime, Biden regime.
The Bushes.
He's always been open to friendly overtures with the United States. And so hopefully that bears fruit with the Trump administration, but, you know, Trump's a mortal man. And probably part of their plan is getting rid of Trump as soon as they can. So,
yeah, you know, no, that's what I'm, no, your analysis is completely correct, Alex, because that's what they're pushing domestically right now. It's why they're trying to push this idea that Trump is weak with the, by overplaying their hand, that the young people are abandoning him and the MAGA is dead and all of this. And you can see it everywhere. Like, and that he's executing illegal orders for, you know, killing pirates on the high seas, which he is. And he's perfectly allowed to do with UNCLOS. And like, it's all dumb, but it's all, It's all nonsense, right? But it's all designed to create an effect. And I've seen it all turn amped up to 11 across every idiom. But at the same time, he's attacking the Langley in Venezuela. Like, again, one of the things to remind you is that Alex and I like to say all roads lead to London. Well, internationally, all roads lead to London. But when anything has to do with it domestically, now you're dealing with all roads lead to Langley. And Venezuela under Maduro, there's a lot there. And there are angles that no one's talking about, going back to, you know, running drugs out of that area of the world during the Bush administration, during the Papa Bush years and all of that stuff, going back to Noriega and all of that. And, you know, one of the things you have to realize is that you're fighting Langley, and then how Langley is attached to the British and or the Canadian banks and this whole architecture of organized crime that has been the lifeblood, the unofficial lifeblood of these agencies and of that, you know, of the American empire, for lack of a better term, or the Anglo-West empire, whatever you want to call it, I don't care. Like, and realize that Trump is attacking that at the same time. And that's another pressure point. And I have to admire his audaciousness. He's attacking on both of these fronts at the same time. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to be successful or not. And that's where Alex's, you know, crossed fingers, you know, come to bear. But that's clearly what he's doing. And I applaud him for doing it, because it needs to be done. Because if we're going to get through the midterms, right, such that he can stay in power, and then really execute on the rest of his plan, then, yeah, we could be looking at a world without war, without all, you know, not without war, but we're going to watch a series of skirmishes as opposed to a big global conflict. And series of skirmishes are fine, because that's, you know, you've got all these armies that have been built to fight World War III. You're not going to get out from underneath, you know, you have to get rid of them in many ways. And so the Russians have done their job. They killed the Ukrainian army, which was built by NATO to fight the Russians. Now you've got to start fighting all the other, you got to get rid of all the other ones. And that's like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and, you know, all what Ian Burlingame calls the devil's legions, right? All of these different little groups. And those also exist at the financial level as well. Like the NGOs and all of that stuff. And that's what Epstein's all about. So these are like it. All of these plot threads that we've been dealing with our entire lives are starting to be pushed towards their conclusion right here, right now. And it's made the battle space almost impossible to handicap, I think, because there's so many different ways to discuss it. But, you know, if you go back to the root, if you go back to just like root cause analysis of, you know, what the real conflict is, right, then a lot of the battle space makes a lot more sense. And I think that's what, you know, Alex and I have been trying to illuminate and figure out over time together, you know, in all the shows that we've done together. I don't know if I think that's correct, Alex. So
yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Now, okay, let's assume, and I hate assuming anything, but let's assume that this peace talks ends the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Mm-hmm. Tom, you said then as an analyst, I start to go, well, where is it heading next? Mm-hmm. Where do you see it heading next?
U.S. Civil War.
Whoa.
That's what they're planning. That's what they're doing right now. That's what Langley is doing right now. They're prepping the battle space for a U.S. Civil War as retaliation for not. I mean, it's obvious that that's what they're prepping with the battle space right now. And that's also why you're seeing Canada getting pressured the way it's getting pressured by Mark Carney and the globalists. They're literally they're making England, Ireland, Canada, the entire Commonwealth into a scorched earth scenario, so that when, so that if the Americans do get out from underneath and do declare their independence, there's nothing left for them to, for them to save. They'll have destroyed Ireland, they'll have destroyed England, they'll have destroyed Canada, and, you know, and then they'll leave a mess for us to clean up, just like they've destroyed Ukraine. Ukraine is a scorched earth policy as well. Just like they wanted to, they want to leave everything a scorched earth policy.
Hold on, Sean,
and go look at a map of where there are Democratic governors. Overlay that with all of the major water routes in the United States, and it's pretty clear what the strategy is. As always, the British will deny you ports. Why are they so obsessed with Crimea and Odessa? Because they understand that ship, that that global trade runs along the runs across oceans, not across land masses. Because land masses, as we find out, are really easy to sabotage the movement of goods and services. You blow up a pipeline, you blow up a rail bridge or whatever. But, you know, ships can go around mines that are like planted in the ocean, right? You have to engage on the high seas in a different way. It's a much different method of war fighting than it is to fight ground assets. And so you bind down the international ports. What, again, think about it this way. What's the United States superpower? It's North America, separated from the rest of the conflict zones by two oceans. Well, if you take access to the oceans away from America, is America have a superpower anymore? It's a good question. I'm telling you, I'm not saying it's what's reality. It's the way they're thinking. I'm trying to put you into the minds of the evil people and what their next move would be. And so it's very clear. That's why we have J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, why we have Tina Kotex in Oregon, Gavin Newsom in California, Kathy Hochul in New York. And like Massachusetts is now declaring themselves an anti-ICE state. Like they're all doing it. Because what they're starting to do now is they're starting to say states' rights. We have the right to, you know, keep to poison our children with bad food. We're going to reject MAHA. And we're going to have our own healthcare alliance with our own healthcare standards that are not federal. These are all laying. This is exactly the same crap that they did in the lead up to the Civil War in between 1857 and 1860 or the 1850s. And they used slavery as the casus belli. Now it's going to be, you know, stop creamsicle Mussolini. It's retarded, but it is what it is. Okay, and that's why he can't walk away from these peace negotiations looking like he gave Putin everything, because then that gives them a talking point to then say, see, Trump's really a traitor. He just sold the country out to the Russians. The Never Trumpers of the Bill Kristol set and the Lindsey Graham set will ally with Gavin Newsom to stop him on this. It's no different than what they did to Ron Paul when he showed up in 2008. It's exactly the same. You had Bill Kristol and Hillary Clinton nominally on different sides of the, at the time, Hillary was your arch Democrat. Kristol was your arch National Review, you know, Weekly Standard conservative. And they were both on Fox News going, yeah, Ron Paul's completely unacceptable. The neocon and the neoliberal agreed on one thing. Can't have peace. Can't have a return to any kind of American sovereigntist policy. And it's, you know, once you saw it in 2008, it's the same crap they're doing today. And guess who's in charge of the media? The media never met a war it didn't like. Yes, because it's run by the British. And most of it's run out of MI6 and Langley. 90% of our friggin' MSM is all intelligence services, maps to intelligence services of one type or another.
Yeah, exactly. And you could totally see that during the Russiagate.
Mm-hmm.
Because Russiagate was an amazing thing, because the only network that was covering it halfway correctly was Fox News. And mm-hmm. among the Fox News anchors, it was Sean Hannity. And Sean Hannity was covering it in a way that was pro-Trump, but he figured out how to keep it still anti-Russian. And so practically every evening when he was reporting on Russiagate, he always had this slogan, Russian lies, Russian disinformation, and phony dossier concocted by foreign nationals. But he never said that those foreign nationals were practically all British. Mm-hmm. You know, Stefan Halper, Joseph Mifsud, mm-hmm. Christopher Steele. It was all MI6 people. But he never said that. It's like you can criticize Israel way more than you can criticize London, the Brits. You can never mention the Brits. You can never, you know, like, when was the last time you heard anything critical of Great Britain on US mainstream media? Never. I can't remember a single once, anything. You know, like, mm-hmm. like a critical report, you know, are we really independent of this little nation? What is this special relationship? Why can't we talk about this? But, you know, so that's that to me was a very clear indication that they control the media. I don't know how, but they do. Well, I mean, I think I know how, because they took it over. They you know, the key editors, directors, they're all on the same line. When the U.S. media space was being consolidated through the 1980s and 1990s, you know, like from 50 or 60 media corporations to like 5 or 6 now, it was all done with the same money. And one of the big players was Rupert Murdoch, and Rupert Murdoch took over the Wall Street Journal, and I don't know what else he took over. Then you have Michael Bloomberg, and Rupert Murdoch is, you know, like he came out of nowhere from Australia, and now he's like the world's biggest media magnate. How? What money? What money? And you know, if you dig a little bit, is the Rothschild money? He's the Rothschild guy, and so that's who controls your media space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Alex. This is part of the thing why, you know, people get I get a lot of flack for not, you know, complaining about Israel enough, and why do you constantly complain about the British and not the Israelis? I'm like, it's because that's the conversation we're not allowed to have. We're all allowed to now begin to at least have some of the conversation about what Israel has done right and wrong, but we're never allowed to have a conversation about how the only thing we're allowed to say in relation to the British is that it was the British who helped create Israel. Everything else doesn't matter. And well, so
Israel is downstream from the city of London.
Of course it is. Of course it is, Alex. But my point is that what I've been trying to do, and I've been, I'm not just open and honest about it. I'm like, I don't give a damn. Like, I'm going to emphasize the British influence in all of this in order to finally pound it through people's skulls through repetition, somewhat unfairly, in a very British manner. Oh, by the way, this is the conversation we're not allowed to have. And we have to have that conversation if we're going to go forward, because otherwise we're just going to be thrown into the slop of, oh, it's all the Jews again. And then we're going to, you know, like, what else is new? Then they get scapegoated and turned into something else, or the Muslims get scapegoated, or this one gets scapegoated. That's what they do. It's that whole Alex's metaphor of the ant jar, of the red ants and the black ants, when who's shaking the fucking jar, folks? Why are we never looking at the guy shaking the damn jar? As opposed to asking the question of whether Russia's right for having invaded Ukraine, or the Ukrainians are right in having bombed the people in the Donbass for being separatists. So, you know, none of that matters. Who did that? Who were the Americans who were working in the State Department and in our Congress with the British in order to create that? Who created the Maidan? You think Victoria Nuland is an American? You think John McCain worked for America? I'm sorry. Yeah, like, sorry to flush out your headgear, new guy, but we don't waste gooks for freedom, to quote Animal Mother from Full Metal Jacket. Like, it's time to like dispense with the childish shit. This is the story that we have to be telling. And then even if it's even if we frame it unfairly in the moment, fine, let's get the conversation started and then we can fill in the details. And then we can find out where the line between modern Israeli intelligence, you know, intelligence stuff, modern American intelligence problems and British stuff, where those lines are. Let's have that conversation. Let's have a much more nuanced conversation about this, understanding who the actual, you know, who the one that's, you know, shaking the jar, poking the snake, doing the thing, and whose ox is actually being gored. That's why I brought up the Bushes earlier in Venezuela. That's why you're going to watch this process play itself out going, you know, with Maduro. And I'll be honest with you. Trump, like, Maduro knows who was running all those drugs out of Venezuela, Colombia, Panama for all those years. We all know what this was about, Noriega and all that stuff. Is Maduro going to finally, you know, give up the thumb drive or not? And it's the same thing with Putin, right? Like, Putin can't commit completely to Trump in these negotiations or in any of these geopolitical things because Trump might not survive. He has to hedge his bet that Trump might not survive this. So he has to negotiate hard, and he's doing so by putting his men on the ground and taking territory in Kiev, in Ukraine. Trump has to negotiate hard by telling Putin, I am looking to clean up all of these British old British conflicts and French conflicts. That allays Putin's fears, right? And it also strengthens Trump's domestic position at the same time. It solves all of those problems, so then they can come together. But they're not going to be able to come together and sing kumbaya about this stuff until either after Trump's term is over, until at least after the midterms, because you've got a Congress in the United States that still is on both sides of the aisle, is just looking for an excuse to get rid of Trump and go back to the status quo. And that's the political reality of the situation. And so this is why I have zero fucking patience for any of these American commentators who don't want to be sucking Trump's dick or whatever the hell they say on a regular basis. Like, no, you have a general fight. This is it. This is your chance. And if you are a weak-kneed little bitch, fine. Then be a weak-kneed bitch, but be silent about it while we go fix this thing. Because this is the general you've got, whether you like it or not, whether he's perfect or imperfect. Because all you're doing now is helping the enemy take him down. And I'm looking at you, Robert Barnes, and I'm looking at you, Rich Barris, and I'm looking at you, Rand Paul, I'm looking at you, Thomas Massey, and all you fucking assholes. Like, you want to save the world? Stop being a bitch. Or are you on someone's payroll? I leave that for the audience to determine. But I'm, you know, it's not even that I'm like pot committed here. I'm pot committed to saving the world, right? We all are. That's why we do what we do. And these people aren't, clearly. And we have to recognize that. And we have to be willing. And now at this moment in time, this is when you call out the people, because this is when you find out who is on the side of not the angels, but on the side. This is a fight of good or evil. That's it. It's what we're dealing with. We know it's a fight of between good and evil. So let's just call it what it is and decide. And then we'll. And if we overcommit and we make mistakes in the process, we can fix that. All we can do is fix those in post. But this is going to be messy. This is going to be hard. This is not going to go. We're not going to go out of this bloodless. We've already got how many dead Slavs that the British like sit there and have their tea at 3 o'clock and laugh about. Okay. While they try to seed the world with all of their Indian proxies to take control of the managerial class around the world to stop any real fight from happening. We had that conversation. We had a part of that conversation the other day with Ian Burlingame and Crypto Rich. So like, there's like a half dozen more dimensions to this than we can even cover today. So, but let's at least start having that conversation. Alex?
No, nothing to add. I agree. Okay. I agree. This is the Well, you know, the whole Indian dimension, you know, that's, I'm not going to say it's new to me. It's just like something I haven't paid attention to, but I did, you know, over the summer, I sat with a Croatian, like, military intelligence guy who was just pointing out that, like, don't you think it's weird that the Indians and Nepalese became the largest minority population in Croatia? Nothing to do with India. We never had anything to do with India, you know. It just doesn't, it just wouldn't happen spontaneously. Like, tens of thousands of people from India wouldn't just say, like, hey, you know, it's shitty here. Let's all go to Croatia because, you know.
Right.
But somehow it happened. Somehow it happened. And then they all work for this Israeli food delivery company called Wolt, which is everywhere around Europe. And I don't know what the hell they're doing other than delivering food, but all of a sudden it's all the rage. And so they're, you know, like he was saying, well, you know, they're mapping out the place, you know, like they're getting information about people who orders what, you know, people's telephone numbers, people's addresses, whatever. Okay, whatever. I don't see it, but clearly something to look into. And then, you know, when Ian Burlingham started into, you know, all these key companies, they have, there's always like an Indian CEO or an Indian person on the board of directors. You know, not that there's anything wrong with Indians in that sense, but, you know, they clearly like to cede key positions with people who are outsiders, who have no bond of loyalty to the local community. You know, like, they come to a company, they're loyal to the company that pays their salary, mm-hmm. and they barely know who lives in that community. So, you know, it gives them a lever of influence, and that influence could turn out to be critical at some inflection point in the conflict.
Right.
So I guess, you know, like I don't have a strong opinion about it, but I have enough of an opinion about it that I would, if I were, you know, like if I were near the seat of power, I'd be like, let's have a look at that. Let's map out who came into what position at what company and what this might mean. Mm. And does that make us vulnerable if somebody decides to call up all these Indians and say, okay, now you're doing this or you're going to lose your job? You know what I mean?
Well, again, though, what we've seen here in the United States is we've seen a lot of this at the at the managerial level. You get people coming in, get hired in at, you know, an upper management level position, or and then they just use the H-1B visa program to hire in, you know, an entire department full of Indian people. And what's worse is that if you guys noticed, like for the last couple of years, Alex, you probably noticed this because you follow the financial markets like I do, which is that we kept saying, well, the labor market's in really better shape than we think. Look at the JOLTS numbers, which is basically the number of job listings that are out there. And the JOLT numbers kept coming up, you know, really high. So there's clearly a lot of demand for labor out there. Well, no, actually, when you actually dig down into it, and I've had this come back to me from multiple people who were laid off and they're professionals and they should have no problem getting another job if the JOLTS numbers were true or even close to true and correct. And they're not, they weren't. These people were, you know, a year, 18 months, 2 years. They would go through multiple rounds of interviews and everything else. And at the last moment, the company would ghost them. And then the job, you know, so what you saw was they were going through the motions to get the grants and to prove to the government that they were doing the right hiring process, but they had always determined that they were going to hire their cousin Habib. And that's what was going to happen, but they had to go through this process. And then they, you know, would bring in the H-1B. This has happened. If I've heard this story once, I've heard it 24 times in the last 2 years. And the JOLTS numbers bear all this stuff out. Then you look at the way FHA was giving out FHA mortgages to illegal immigrants, and like all this money. So we were being invaded this way, and it was a silent invasion through the managerial through the managerial revolution, and that's that. And so and what we should be watching for now is how the bid and for the, how the contracting and the bid contracting process in the United States is changing. This is part of what DOGE actually did, and this is also part of the reason why DOGE as a separate organization was gotten rid of, because it just created a separate bureaucracy. It just embedded the DOGE mechanisms into all of the cabinet level departments in order to reverse the money flow and the way that was happening, because that's all part of, you know, the H-1B problem. It's all right there. And I know that it's happening in Canada as well. So, you know, Mark Carney's made it abundantly clear he wants to double the population of Canada in the next 7 years. And it's mostly going to be Indian immigration. And again, this is not, you know, this is one of those things where if you want to create, you know, a red ant, black ant scenario, this is how you do it. So, and again, who's doing this? And when you trace this back, it all goes right back to London. All day, every day. Sorry, that's the way it works. And where they can, they will blame the Jews by putting, they'll put a Jew in charge of a particular company in order to, like, they do this on purpose. Like, this shit is everywhere, folks. So everything you think you know about the way the world actually operates and the way the world operates completely, those are two radically different things. And 90% of the stuff you see on social media is either bots or a lie. Period. And it's that part of the information space is being flooded at this point. And the best word and the zeitgeist word of the day is slop, and it's literally everywhere. And you can't get away from it. So I think I've made Sean speechless.
Oh, I thought he broke.
I broke Sean.
No, I'm conscious of letting Alex here at a good time, so I don't say right. Something and then it spurs on for 20 minutes, right? Like right. Normally when we schedule these, we schedule them a little bit earlier in the day. That way we don't get Alex at, you know, midnight essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sitting here and I'm stewing on a bunch of the things you say, but I'm like, if I say anything right now, I'm like, I'm going to spur on another 20 minutes conversation. And probably what I should do is just wrap it up so that Alex can get out of here at a good time. We can schedule another one so that we're a little earlier in the day, so that I don't have to worry about Alex falling asleep on us. And that's probably what I should do. I have questions and I have a lot of different things. You know, when you bring up Canada and Carney and scorched earth, and I'm like, man, I want to dig right into that.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm like, you know, I'm looking at the clock going, I promised Alex an hour and we're closing in on that. So I don't know, gents. Probably, I could say a few different things, but I should probably just wrap it up and tell you both thanks for hopping on again, and we can do this again when we have a bit more time, unless Alex is like, ask the questions.
But you know, like I it's okay if we go. I don't have a hard stop. I just have, you know,
end of day. Yes, I know. Well, I guess with Canada and you rattled off a bunch of different places, Tom, when you're talking scorched earth, can you just unpack that for me? What is, because scorched earth puts a bunch of things in my mind. Well, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about being invaded, right? All these places are being invaded, and then that puts massive pressure on the social
structures,
right? and the governmental structures and everything else. It has ballooned housing prices, transportation costs, commodity costs, and everything else in the American economy. So much of the inflation that we felt under Biden wasn't just the money we printed post COVID, but the amount of people that, you know, we still had X, and that we had all this money was being printed. And it was just being handed out to millions of immigrants who were then bidding up the price of everything. Like, and that sets everything in motion. So what do you think is going to happen on the backside of that? You're going to have a bunch of people who, you're going to have a bunch of natives who are angry. You're going to have a bunch of immigrants who just took the handout, and, you know, they're not malicious. They took the handout. Like, you know what I mean? And Then you're going to set those, and then now Trump is going to try and get rid of as many of them as possible. That's a slow process, and the goal is to break the the Canadian government's budget. It's to break the system and then force them into either a hyperinflationary scenario or whatever, and then you're setting native Canadians against Indians, and then. And if the United States wants to annex, the western part of Canada where all the resources are, what are you annexing at that point? You're annexing nothing but a social, headache. It's no different than the Russians don't want anything west of the Dnieper River. Those Ukrainians hate Russians. Why would you want to rule them? It would be nothing but an administrative nightmare for them. So it's the same. That's what I mean by scorched earth in that respect. Alex?
I agree that that's how it is and that's how it's going to play out.
The Indian thing of bringing over people, I go, okay. And the managerial class, that makes sense because, when it comes to all these institutions and how people during COVID were pressured, it came from their governing bodies, the managerial class, mm-hmm. right? There's a ton of money that goes into there and it's a black hole, it's a void. All these groups have way too many, VPs and just that, I think that's been shown over and over again. But like in BC right now, they're having the real discussion on fee simple titles. Right. Like, and to me, you go the Indians from across the sea. I go like, to me, what's brewing here in Canada, whether people are paying attention to it or not, is like your fee simple titles are coming into question. The land, the houses, everything that you own is coming into question. You want to talk about two ants. I'm like, I don't need to look anywhere over the sea to see that. I just look to the west of us, to BC, and seeing that idea spread across Canada. Where you're going to take the very fabric of what civilization is built on and go, oh no, we're gonna call into question that as well.
Well said, Sean. I'm thank you for bringing it up because it is something that we've been discussing internally. I have Canadian patrons who are just freaking out about this. I have friends in British Columbia who are freaking out about this, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. You're correct. Go ahead, Alex.
No, nothing to add.
Okay. All right. So yeah, no, you're right. That's an aspect of scorched earth. Let's destroy property rights. Let's destroy the very foundation on which Western civilization is built.
It's interesting. As that's going on, like the UCP, so Premier Daniel Smith's governing party just had their AGM. Mm-hmm. And there was some booing that happened of her talking about, an independent Alberta and a sovereign Alberta and a united Canada, something like that. And there's a lot of Albertans that want out because they're seeing this fee simple. They're seeing all these different things come in. They're mm-hmm. like, what is happening? But she got a standing O when she talked about criminals. She brought up, if you're a criminal and you come into our house, you're going to, I forget now I'm paraphrasing, my apologies. You're going to have a bullet hole in you type thing. It's castle law, right? And that got a standing ovation from the crowd. Actually, it shocked me if you said it. I'm like, oh man, that's going to get played over and over and over again. And it has already, right? Because in Canada, we don't have castle law. And things that have been playing out across the country is the invader, the intruder, seems to have more rights than the homeowner, right? Of protecting his property and his family and his things. We've got all these things playing out. And, there's a lot of talk of doubling the population and all these things. And there's a lot of that going on, Tom. There is. Mm-hmm. But then I watch the legal system work against the Canadian system. And I'm like, that is more concerning at this point than any group of people coming over and taking what we have. I mean, our judiciary is literally undermining civilization here in Canada.
No argument, Sean, at all. And that was, yes. Again, my original rant about scorched earth, I was on, sometimes you have just so much going through, rattling through your head. Like, I knew about all of this and I should have mentioned it earlier. You're absolutely right to harp on it.
Doesn't mean what you're talking about isn't going on in Canada. It certainly is. It's right. when you're looking at all the problems, it's like, what's one of the biggest ones? I'm in the process of getting people in at the Cornerstone this year to talk about Fee Simple Title, because I feel like everybody knows about it, but if they don't, it's going to shock them. Yeah. Like, you know, you can't possibly underscore the importance of what is happening in BC right now and the fact that it is spreading to other provinces.
It's interesting that that's what's happening in Canada under Mark Carney, while at the same time under Trump, you're watching the reassertion of property rights, but through Ron DeSantis saying we're going to get rid of property tax, which is a 1,000-year-old grift that they've been running to make us serfs on our own land. Like, we're pushing towards, you know, real, honest to God, allodial title, for lack of a better term, and our land again. We don't owe rent to the government in perpetuity, which then, interestingly enough, calls into question the entire idea that we can, that the government has a perpetual income stream that it can use to issue debt against. The whole British system is based on the government being able to create a permanent perpetual revenue stream. Okay. And then we get back, and then now you start really thinking about George Soros and perpetual bonds and all this stuff. And you're like, yeah, well, if you've got a perpetual revenue stream, you can issue perpetual bonds. As long as the perpetual bonds are lower than the tax rate, you know, the interest on as long as the taxes collected are greater than the revenue stream, than the payout stream, right? The revenue is higher than payouts. It's a profitable business. And that's a pathetic way of looking at the world, but that's the way they look at it. And that is an interesting turn of the table. So just,
well, it's very interesting, since it's effectively turning the population into slaves.
Absolutely.
And it, you know, like, it's never going to stay what it is, because the, you know, like, the immutable law of government spending is that it always goes up. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to go like, oh, guess what? You know, like, it's, you know, things are so difficult. We have to raise these taxes. Mm-hmm. They're going to raise them a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. And they're going to figure out exactly the point at which you break. And they're going to go to that point. And then when they reach that point, then they're going to say, like, the Russians are coming. All the fighting age males do the patriotic duty and die on a foreign battlefield. And then they start over again. It always has been a looting operation. And when all the channels for looting have been closed off abroad, then they start looting their own populations. And
yes, Alex.
You know, one thing I wanted to say regarding property rights, I felt that it's always been a big lie, because property rights are part of natural law. It doesn't need to be enshrined in the system. They don't have to list everything, who owns where, who owns what where, and give you a piece of paper. People just naturally recognize this. You don't need special lawyers to deal with. I grew up in the communist world. My parents had an apartment. They had a summer house on an island, the beach house. Another, you know, family friends of ours had a house in the mountains where we went, you know, in the winter too. Nobody ever questioned anybody's property, even though we never, you know, we only filed for those deeds and, you know, land office certificates and all this paperwork once we joined the European Union. Before that, you know, some people did that, other people didn't do that, but nobody came in and said, like, hey, guess what? This is not yours. And if you can't show a paper, the state is just going to take. I've never, ever heard of state taking anybody's property away. That did happen, but it happened kind of in the aftermath of World War II, when, you know, some people were just declared enemy of the state and then their goods were confiscated. But, you know, once the system stabilized, there was no confiscation of property from the state. And it wasn't because people would flip out, you know, like, because you do it to one person, you immediately render the whole society feel insecure. If they did it to them, they might do it to me next. Yep. You know, so people just like freaking flip out, even though There's nothing on any paper, or you know, for the most part, people didn't have papers, but everybody knew, well, this house belongs to this family. But how do we know? Well, because they freaking live there and they built the house. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows it and nobody questions it. That's how it was. You know, like it just was. It was part of natural law. It was the way people related to one another and everybody recognized it. And if you didn't know it, you could just ask somebody who lived in the community and they would tell you. That was the end of it. So once they start, you know, doing all these, well, this is a very known case, in fact, in the 18th century, you know, they couldn't get the Indians off of their land. They wanted to take Indian land and they couldn't. And so what they did is they forced Indians to take land deeds. Mm-hmm. And the Indians were refusing. They were like, what do you mean land deeds? This is our land. I don't need no right. fucking deed. And they forced them to accept deeds to say, your land is from here to here and from here to here. That's your land, yours. And here's a paper proving it. Now you have property. Before that, that property was simply theirs by the grace of God. And they took it as such and they used it as such. And it was the weirdest thing for them to go to the Western paper system that supposedly guarantees property rights. But once you have that, then you have a millions of ways of screwing people, squeezing them, forcing them to sell, taxing them. You know, like if it ain't on paper, how are you going to tax it?
Yep.
So that whole thing is a lie. It's an inversion of what's actually intended. What's actually intended is the great taking. You will own nothing and you will be happy. And you know, like in this British Commonwealth countries like Canada, you can see it. It's gone the farthest ahead, and you can see it in action. You can see like the steamroller slowly crushing people. And people don't understand. They say, like, well, this is mine. How can you do this to me? Well, you know, they've been preparing this for a very, very long time.
Yeah, no, you're right, Alex. It's an interesting process. So we've gone so far, right? And I, you know, no matter what you do, like where you have to realize that we've gone so far in the one direction towards defining everything about our property and deeds and, you know, and all of this stuff. And now, but how do you roll that back when you said, well, this is my land, but you can't tax it because we're going to get rid of property tax. Well, how can we get rid of property tax and pay for government? We run a massive surplus here in Florida, so we can do that. It's not a problem. It's only 18% of the budget. We can figure out other ways of paying for the schools. We can figure out other ways. We can float a bond and pay for the schools. We can do other things. We do not have to tax people based on their land.
Yeah. I live in a principality that has no income tax.
Right.
Zero. Income tax is zero.
Yeah.
So all these stories about how we're going to fund the government, they're lying to you.
Oh, of course they are. Florida, there's no income tax in Florida either. We have no income tax. We have relatively high property tax. So they just want to get rid of property tax for residential, for, you know, homesteaded residential property. Now, homesteaded in Florida is a legal term, which says that this is your primary residence. You take a homestead exemption against it. It can't be taken by the federal government. It can't be taken from you in any way. But they can put a tax lien against the property, so you can't sell it without paying the tax lien. But if we do away with property tax, then that gets rid of that as well. Like, so then all of a sudden, like, it's like a random acts of a freedom start to happen. But what you're trying to do here is to free people from the mindset of all of this, you know, of all this categorization and delineation and lawyers and this, and all of that stuff is very, very important to how the British system perpetuates itself. Okay. And that's to Alex's point about, look, we all know that that's, you know, their house over there. They built the damn thing. And does it matter whether the plot of land around that house goes to that tree or to that stone or not? Like, you know, that's at that point that people just argue about it a little bit. They come to a decision, and, you know, and that's that. Like, don't put a rock wall there. Move it 5 feet that way. Could you please? Like, you know what I mean? And then figure it out. It's only when people are trying to get one over on somebody else because you've lost trust in the society. What Alex is describing is, interestingly enough, a high trust society.
Yeah, right. That's true. That was the high trust society.
Right. In a high trust society, we don't have to worry about this stuff. Like,
yeah, we copy pasted all the, you know, EU laws. And now we have a deteriorating trust society. But we really did have a high trust society, not thanks to Marxism, not thanks to communism, but just because that system people. Was so dysfunctional that it left a lot of space for people to just figure it out themselves.
Exactly.
And people fell back on natural law and functioned under natural law. And I promise you, for that reason, I felt much, much freer under communism than I ever had living in the West under this, you know, democracy, freedom, and human rights.
Random acts of anarchism.
Yeah.
One other question. You brought up people pointing to the Jews. Mm-hmm. And I a question for the both of you on this. We point to all these different groups and how they're being used by the City of London. Couldn't the Jews just be another group in that long string of how they push them out into the world and then foment those groups against the populations? So couldn't the Jews just be as guilty as the Indians, as the Muslims, as on and on and on?
That's the point I was making earlier, Sean. Yes, absolutely. And in that you partner with these people and then they betray you. And, you know, it's just, you know, and that process of creating a, you know, of creating that, that tension point, right, that irritant, then creates a reaction from somebody else. Let's say, I don't know, the Soviet Union, who's trying to stop the British from colonizing the entire Middle East or North Africa or Eastern Europe. Or so then you see a lot of the more I think about my own history in my lifespan, and I look at, you know, the Russian activity or the old Soviet activity, I used to look at it from an American perspective. I now look at it as an American British project, right? Where the Americans, you know, through intelligence service, being intelligence services fellow travelers, for lack of a better term, right? That the government, that the people who actually run these governments, the intelligence services and whatnot, and are all fellow travelers, meaning they've all got the same desired end, right? It doesn't matter about nationality at that point. But the Russians see the situation, and the Cold War can be reframed as what all we're trying to do is stop, as opposed to American imperialism. Because we get blamed for everything, just the same way that the Jews get blamed for everything, the same way now we're trying to blame the Indians for everything. Oh, no, really, it was the British doing it. We were just doing it. We were just their proxies. So now if you go back and start to think of the 300-year-old fight between the British and the Russians for control of the world island, to Alex's point earlier, bringing up Halford Mackinder, that makes more sense. And now that's why I'm like, watch Putin and Trump very carefully as they negotiate the end of all these old, what looked like American-Soviet
conflicts
when they're really Russian-British conflicts. And that's how they build trust with each other. And that's how they're, you know, trying to de-escalate the world bit by bit, moment by moment. But of course, as they do that, then you're, of course, going to get a reaction. You're going to get an ab reaction that's going to try and stop that from happening. And that's where you then start mapping the political forces who then are trying to stop those things from happening.
Yeah.
Because it makes no sense that people wouldn't want peace, right? And yet, somehow, we never get peace.
Well, maybe peace in our time. Who knows? Alex, maybe. Tom, appreciate you guys coming on and doing this. And look forward to seeing you guys here in March. I should point out, people can get their tickets to Cornerstone Forum. Early bird prices are on sale until December 31st. You two fine gentlemen are going to be there along with a whole cast of characters. And look forward to seeing you both in person again. We'll chat before then, but certainly thanks for giving me time again today, gentlemen.
Excellent. Always a pleasure, Sean. Take care.
Thank you.